How did it happen that you personally came to study the effects of hallucinogens on terminal cancer patients?
Well, actually, that my interest in this area dates back some time. In the early 1970s, I had an opportunity to examine the literature from psychiatric research with hallucinogens, and it was really very impressive and also very disturbing that this very promising area of research with significant clinical implications had been derailed by the cultural and political turmoil of that time. I also had the opportunity in the early 70s, I believe it was in late 1972, to hear a lecture in New York City by Stanislav Grof, the Czech researcher who had moved to the U.S. in 67 and had done some extraordinary work treating patients with terminal cancer, treating them for their anxiety, depression, demoralization, treating them with different hallucinogens, usually administering one treatment session only, or in some cases, a couple of treatment sessions. Stan Grof got remarkable results, and hearing him speak about his study in the early 70s really inspired me to, or at least kindled the hope that one day I might have the opportunity to develop a similar research project.
Okay, so that was 1972. How do you get to now where you're being funded to give an illegal drug to people who are terminally ill? That's a pretty big leap.
Right. Well, a lot of time has elapsed.
Yeah.
You know, I did realize that in order to do this research the way I felt I wanted to be involved, I needed to have the proper credentials. So, I went back to school, did all my pre-medical requirements, went to medical school with the hope that once I graduated medical school, I could join an active research project exploring the clinical effects of hallucinogens. However, by the time I graduated in the late 70s, everything had been shut down nationwide. There were no studies, approved studies at that point, exploring the range of effects of hallucinogens, and there were certainly no studies working with terminally ill patients. So I just continued with my training. I trained in a few different areas, amassing credentials, and stayed in academic faculty positions, first at Johns Hopkins and at University of California at Irvine. And for the last 21 years, I've been at Harbor UCLA Medical Center and in Torrance, which is in South LA. And in the late 80s, when I was at UC Irvine, I met a couple of colleagues who shared my view that this was an area that needed more study and that it was really unfortunate that everything had been stopped in its tracks by the late 60s, early 70s. So with a colleague, I mapped out a plan to put together a protocol exploring the range of effects of these drugs. During that time, I moved over to Harbor UCLA, where I had really good support from my department chairman, Dr. Miller, and also the current chairman, Dr. Lesser, and the Los Angeles Biomedical Research Institute, where I conduct my research. And I also was asked to join the board. I'm actually a founding board member for the Hefter Research Institute, which is dedicated to helping to fund and develop research projects with hallucinogens. And the times had changed. You know, enough time really had begun to elapse. Enough distance had been created from the 60s and all the turmoil that I think the regulatory agencies were able to look at this area in a more objective, dispassionate manner and really assess it on its scientific and potential clinical merits. And we've had a good experience with the regulatory agencies, with FDA, with DEA, with the California Research Advisory Panel. Sending them our protocols. They always had critiques, and they would send it back to us, and we would address their concerns. And at the end of the day, I think we came up with a better protocol. So I'm appreciative for that process. And we also receive the necessary approvals. We got most of our funding through Hefter Research Institute. I will say that getting funding from the National Institutes of Health has been very elusive, and we have not been successful there, although hope springs eternal in regards to the future.
Well, I can imagine. Let's be honest. This is pretty controversial, what you're doing. I mean, this is an illegal drug. People have Timothy Leary spinning in their head, right. and this idea of somebody at a Grateful Dead concert, it's illegal, I might add, is that I can imagine that it's hard for you to, there must be even a PR side of it. It must be difficult for you guys to get it through.
Well, it was not possible in the 70s. It was not possible in the 80s. By the early 90s, it started to be possible. The memory of Tim Leary was fading. His antagonists, they were exiting the stage. Eventually, by the mid 90s, Leary exited the stage, and I think it was possible to have a sane, rational discussion.
Right.
And I think also there was sufficient indication from the early investigations in the 50s and the 60s to really lend hope and credence to the notion that there may very well be valuable treatment models here, particularly for patient populations that do not respond well to conventional treatments. And I feel we've been able to establish strong safety parameters, and that's been critical in moving this field forward. We've established feasibility, that we could actually do this study, get all the approvals, conduct the study, and we've established good safety parameters and also some indication of therapeutic efficacy, at least with our preliminary studies. But it was, it's been possible to a far greater degree than had been the case decades previous to have a rational, objective discussion on the merits without pulling in the ghosts of the 60s. I think we need to let those ghosts rest in peace.
Rest in peace, Timothy Leary. Take me through this. So someone, let's give a hypothetical example. Someone's diagnosed, they have terminal lymphoma. They're going to have 1 to 3 months to live. They volunteer to be a part of your research. How does it work? I mean, do they come to you and say, or their doctor comes to you and says, I'm completely, this patient's overwhelmed with grief from their own possible death, and then you work with them? How does it work that you get these people?
Well, I will say that recruitment for the study of subjects was challenging. Essentially, we were looking for people with a terminal diagnosis, but who were sufficiently functional and ambulatory that they could come to see us at the hospital for first screening, and if they screened in, if they passed all the inclusion criteria, did not have any of the exclusion criteria, then we saw them for several appointments, kind of helping to prepare them for the experience, helping to give them a sense of the terrain they would be going through. We got to learn about their histories. We established rapport. We kind of understood what their salient issues were at this particular moment in time. And then we had them come in on two separate occasions, spaced a few weeks apart, to our clinical research unit at Harbor UCLA and the LA Biomed Research Institute, where my research associate and I sat with them for 6 hours, and we administered a moderate dose of psilocybin, and we just sat with them. We had them listen to pre-selected music. We had really good quality headphones connected to the CD player that they could use. They wore eye shades, and we guided them through the terrain, and our subjects did very, very well.
What's that scene like? I mean, psilocybin, such a powerful substance. My God, do they have a blanket from home? are they picking their own music? What's the scene like for them? Because I know that scene really affects that kind of substance.
Right. Well, we start with your typical drab hospital room, and we fixed it up very nicely. My two associates that I work with, Alicia Danforth and Mary C. Haggerty, both were very inventive in coming up with ways to really make the room more attractive, more appealing. We had lots of fabrics hanging from the ceiling, kind of cocooning them in, a curtain of fabrics around them. We brought in flowers for the day of the session. We had some really nice wall hangings, and we encourage subjects to bring in important mementos, particularly photographs from their past, including early past, and photographs of important relatives. So, it was quite a moving experience to sit with them for those many hours while they went deep into the experience, for the most part just lying quietly in bed, eyes closed, eye shades on, headphones on, listening to music. Every hour we checked in with them, checked the blood pressure. I checked in, made sure they were okay. There was an opportunity to chat a little bit then, but, you know, I urged them to go deep into the experience. I reminded them there would be plenty of time after the session was over that day and subsequent days and weeks to process what was going on, to help with integration. And we were also, my research associate and I were also by their bedside for the entire 6 hours of the experience, and we were there to... At any point, they could take off the headphones, take off the eye shades, sit up and talk to us if there was anything they wanted to tell us. But I didn't want to engage in too much conversation during the acute effect stage. So again, I would encourage them after a while to just go deeply, and we would have lots of time later on to talk about what they were experiencing.
You know, I can't. I mean, we're talking about going deeply into their experience. These are people who are about to die. So the experience they're going deeply into is their own death. That's some heavy business. What was it like for you, like say your first person you were with, knowing this person is about to die and they're going pretty deep into some pretty heavy stuff. What was it like for you just to be observing? That must have felt heavy for you as well.
It was a very moving experience. I felt honored. I felt honored to be there with these very courageous individuals who volunteered to work with us. And you know, look, they're going through what is a universal process, approaching the end of life. And both from a professional and a personal standpoint, I learned a great deal. And at the end of the day, I'm very grateful to the participation of those 12 subjects who worked with us on our study.
Why do you think they want to do this?
Well, again, this is not a treatment for everyone. It's almost as if someone needs to feel a calling or be called to that experience. But for those who understand and who feel drawn to it, you know, while we had the approved study open, I should say also that the study has been closed now for a few years. We're hoping to open it up again, but we're going to need more funding for that. Now I lost my place. Where was I?
I was just asking why people would choose to do this.
Yeah, why they would choose to do it. You know, a sense that there's, well, I think many of our subjects were experiencing, you know, profound existential issues. They had lost their sense of meaning and purpose. And I think there was a sense that not only might the experience help them to be less anxious and less depressed, it might also provide for them a renewed sense of self and an understanding of their mission in life, their role in life. It kind of reconnect them with their core identity, which the illness often kind of takes them away from.
Can you give me an example? Is there some particular person you can think of that you just was profoundly changed by this experience and you saw it happen?
Sure. There was one woman who, this was her first experience ever with a hallucinogen. She was in her, she's around 50 years old. I'll tell you the story. She was naive to the experience. She had a great deal of anxiety, had been isolating herself from friends, had kind of retreated from the world, waiting to die, and was just in a psychologically very disturbed state. That was her self-report. During the experience, I should say first off that she, at the one-hour point when initially people start to inform us that there's something going on internally, she told us she wasn't having any experience yet. At the second-hour point, the same. At the third-hour point, she still said she wasn't having any experience. And I told her, well, put on the eye shades, put on the headphones, go deep, something will happen. And I started to be concerned. Now, our model was we had a placebo control It's double-blind, placebo-controlled. So they came in on two separate occasions, once for the active medicine, once for a placebo. This is her second session. I was fairly sure, although I didn't know for sure, but I was fairly certain that she had received a placebo the first time. So I'm thinking, gee, could there have been a mistake? Could we have been administered two placebos with this patient? But, you know, at the four-hour point, when she told us that nothing was going on, I had one of the psychiatry residents working with us at that time in the treatment room, and I put him in charge of music selection, and I told him that, you know, I think you're playing music that's too mellow. Do you have anything that's a little more dissonant, that has a little more oomph to it? I think we need to challenge her a little more with what we're playing. And he said, well, I have nothing up here, but down in my car, I have Dead Can Dance.
Yeah. Oh, that's a great choice.
Lisa Gerrard and Dead Can Dance. Yeah. That was perfect. So I said, okay, go get it. He races down to the parking lot, gets the CD, brings it up, pops it in, and within 10 minutes, the floodgates had opened, and tears are streaming down her face. And, you know, I just let her, you know, cathart, let her cry. And meanwhile, I'm assuming that why she's crying is because she's getting in touch with her shortened life expectancy. But when I checked in at the next hour point, I found out that that was nothing at all like what was really going on internally for her, that her subjective experience was essentially getting in touch with memories of her father, who had long since been deceased. And she said she cried for the lost opportunities she had had while he was still alive to tell him how much she loved him. And they were not an expressive family. And she cried because while she knew that he loved her, he had never expressed that to her. So in the experience, it was a very, very powerful, even dramatic cathexis with the memory of her deceased father. And really healing a lot of the old wounds that she had carried with her from early life through her adulthood. And for her, it was a very, very healing experience. And afterwards, she, you know, her anxiety appeared much less. She had previously, before the study, been on an antidepressant, which for the purposes of the study had agreed to go off of, but fully expecting to start taking it as soon as her treatment was over with us. But afterwards, she found no need to go back on the antidepressant.
Incredible.
That it really seemed to re-equilibrate her mood. Now, all that being the case, this is an N of one. This is just one subject's report. But we did find with our 12 subjects overall that there were some indications of therapeutic outcome. And then in some measures, at some points in time, we did reach significant difference of subject reports on experimental medicine versus those who had reports from placebo.
You know, that's one of the questions I wanted to ask, because I understand the person, you know, has an experience while they're tripping and that lasts some hours afterwards. But say they pass away a couple months later, how long does that go? I mean, how long did that positive, profound change last? Did you survey family members or themselves months later to see how long that lasted?
Sure, absolutely. I mean, not with all, but with some subjects, there did really seem to be a persistent therapeutic effect in regards to lessening of anxiety, improved mood, improved sense of morale, improved sense of purpose and meaning to life.
I would remind everyone. After one experience.
Mm-hmm.
That's incredible.
Right.
I mean,
well, but again,
you're a scientist.
Don't
you find that kind of incredible?
Well, you know, it's interesting, and
it's
we can't make
okay.
too much of it because, again, it's a limited subject sample. We would certainly have to study far more subjects to determine whether or not this is a therapeutic agent that can be safely administered. That was our experience, but we were a pilot study. I'll also say that after we started our study, two other fairly high-powered research groups on the East Coast conducted very similar studies, one at Johns Hopkins and the other at NYU, and they only recently have completed treating all of their subjects. They're now analyzing their data, and I'm, you know, very much looking forward to seeing what their data actually looks like. You know, their reports just offhand have been that it appears that their subjects are doing well, but we won't know for sure until they crunch the data and we see what it looks like. And so right now, I think the Hopkins study and the NYU study are going to be very helpful in informing us whether or not this is a worthy area to continue to investigate. I do anticipate we're going to hear of good results, but we have to wait and see for sure what's going on.
You know, I would assume, you know, at least a number of our listeners have taken hallucinogens before. You know, mushrooms with the friends in the woods, mescaline at a rave, LSD at a Grateful Dead concert, or some, maybe even a few have taken DMT if they want to take a little bit further. I bet if I asked them all in a survey, if they wanted to take a bunch of hallucinogens in a hospital and contemplate their own death, they would say, man, that sounds like a terrible trip. That is a bad trip. Obviously, for patients, it was not a bad trip. What's the difference?
Well, you know, again, going back to the 60s and Stan Grof studies, as well as some other investigators, I mean, their clinical reports are as moving and as profound as any clinical reports I've ever seen in psychiatry. I think when individuals are really confronting, you know, such a challenging predicament as the approaching end of life, you know, they are willing to let's say, you know, undertake such an experience as we offered. All of our subjects were quite, expressed a lot of gratitude that this opportunity was open to them. And of course, I think if we had asked them years earlier when they were in their prime of health, if they would like to take a hallucinogen under, you know, on a clinical research unit in a big academic medical center, you know, most of them, I would not likely have accepted such an invitation. I think it really takes extreme circumstance for people to step up and say, I'm willing to try that. And again, our 12 subjects were, I think they displayed remarkable strength and remarkable courage. And I will be eternally grateful to them for their working with us and helping us to, you know, identify whether or not there is merit in this treatment model.
So, doctor, what's happening here? I mean, are you able to explain it? Is this psychological? Is this physical? Is this brain chemistry? I mean, why is there change?
Certainly, there's a neurobiological perspective, and some of my colleagues around the world, particularly in Switzerland and in the United Kingdom, are very thoroughly exploring the range of effects on the brain. And you know, to that end, we know that hallucinogens, the ones we use, like psilocybin, work primarily on the serotonergic neurotransmitter system. So we know that those subreceptors, 5-HT2A and 2C, are undergoing modulation. But we don't have the definitive answers. And hopefully, you know, those will come along as more studies are undertaken and as the technology becomes more precise. But in terms of what's going on psychologically, I think, again, going back to Stan Grof, who was really did remarkable work paving out a path that today's contemporary researchers in many respects are following. Dr. Grof found that his best therapeutic outcomes were with patients who, during the course of what was often only a one-session treatment, during that experience had a powerful, what he called mystico-mimetic experience, mystical experience, a psycho-spiritual epiphany. Yeah. And it seemed to be that profound spiritual experience caused some kind of re-equilibration, central nervous system, one's sense of self, one's capacity to tolerate stress, that predicted best therapeutic outcome down the line. So, similar results were found even going back to the late 50s with the British-Canadian psychiatrist Humphrey Osmond, who treated a large number of chronic alcoholics at his treatment facility in Saskatchewan in Western Canada. Osmond found, again, that his best therapeutic outcomes were those subjects who, during the course of their one treatment session, had a powerful mystical level experience, and which really reminds me of what William James, known as the founder of modern American psychology, dating back more than 100 years, around the turn of the previous century, William James once said that the best treatment for dipsomania, which is the old term for alcoholism, so the best treatment for dipsomania is religiomania. And, you know, so And again, you know, I think all religions can point to their success stories. But what's so remarkably unique about the hallucinogen model is that you might be able to reliably induce or facilitate these mystical level experience when you use optimal conditions. A contemporary researcher at Johns Hopkins, Roland Griffiths, has done remarkable work there looking at normal volunteers' response to psilocybin and finding, again, that if you control conditions for optimal set and setting, you significantly increase the likelihood of powerful psycho-spiritual experience. And then we see that such an experience may actually be tied in with the therapeutic outcome. I think it really gives us significant understanding that this is an area which, albeit with a very novel mechanism of action, but may indeed have quite impressive therapeutic outcomes. Again, particularly in patient populations that are known not to respond well to conventional treatments.
If you have a, I want to quote you. You wrote something that I thought was very powerful, actually. You wrote that, ideally, dying should be viewed not as a medical problem, but as an important and vital part of life. How does psilocybin fit into that quote from yours, that this is not, end of life is not a medical issue?
Well, I mean, certainly there are obvious medical aspects that can't be ignored in regards to people who are approaching the end of life. But I think this treatment model allows us to step back and take another perspective, the perspective of what is the subjective experience, and really to imbue an individual with a renewed sense of meaning and purpose, even in their final months, weeks, and days, I think has quite significant implications, not only to what treatment models we may want to pursue in the future, but our understanding of right. Of life and the dying process, our final days, and death itself.
If you, and I don't want to jinx your life here, but you know, if you were diagnosed with terminal cancer and had only a few months to live, would you want to take psilocybin in your final days?
Well, I think that would be an option well worth considering, as long as it was feasible to do it in an approved, sanctioned manner with facilitators who knew what they were doing and could help to create optimal conditions. Observing what I observed in my patients who participated in our study, absolutely.
You know, if it seems like, you know, if people want to deal with these loaded issues surrounding death, but they're not actually terminally ill. I mean, I've had existential issues. One of my children was born, I was like, oh my God, you know, I was dealing with that. Do you think that psilocybin would help for people who aren't terminal but still want to come to grips in a proper environment with the idea of death or even the idea of an existential crisis? Would you suggest that?
Well, again, in terms of my suggesting or making such a recommendation, that would really have to do with what is the legal status of this treatment and if there were any approved research studies going on. But, you know, one approach we've considered, you know, my group at Harvard UCLA and the Hopkins and the NYU group, none of us have put together a protocol for this, but what about the possibility of facilitating a treatment for the partner of the individual
absolutely,
who is
right.
dying? Because that person is also quite often in crisis. They're all also dealing with the existential reality that we all die, and that for them, denial has been stripped away because their partner is close to death. So, you know, and also to really help them prepare for the grieving process and to help them with the grief they're already experiencing, anticipating the inevitable and sometimes, you know, impending death of their partner. I think that might be an interesting model to work with next.
Yeah, especially if they did it together. It seems like that could be a very, very, very powerful experience for a couple.
Well, you know, together would have some logistical issues, but I think if they each had such an experience, it might very powerfully solidify and strengthen their connectedness. I would also say that with some of our subjects, what was also quite notable was the very, very significant improvement in the quality of their relationships with significant others. I've had some subjects whose important relationships seem to be on the rocks with, you know, with the stress of what was going on with them, with their terminal illness and also old issues that were entering into the picture. And after their treatment, at least with some of our subjects, it was quite moving to see the manner in which they were able to, in a very healthy way, connect and bond with their significant other and other family members.
You know, this is such an incredible stuff that I've read from you. I've never even heard of this before. I found it really fascinating. If I'm in an elevator with you and don't know you, what's your elevator speech? What's your takeaway from what you've learned about death through you personally, for your experience of watching these people in there?
Well, having been with my subjects and seeing their courage was very heartening to me. And I would feel or say, take heart, that that death need not be an overwhelming existential nightmare. But even in the final moments, there might still be a sense of meaning and a sense of purpose and a sense of moving forward, albeit moving into the unknown, but still a sense of moving forward.
Thank you very much. I'm very impressed and excited to have interviewed you. Thank you.
Thank you.
I think my producer has one more question for me. Sorry.
Okay.
Sure, go ahead.
Right.
Okay.
Right. Well,
let me turn that into a question. So as I hear you describe her, I say to myself, okay, she's dealing with a psychology from her past. Is that part of what you got, that some people are able to take some baggage away from themselves to handle their end days and not just necessarily handle the existential crisis of death itself?
No, I mean, many of our subjects, in addition to the internal aesthetic experience and with some of them a psycho-spiritual experience, many of them often, had an autobiographic experience doing a life review. And at least with some of them, there really was a sense of healing of old wounds, that were holding them back
right
from moving forward.
Cool. Thank you very much.
Sure. Well, thank you.